Good afternoon, everybody. R.C. Blakes here. This is in response to two emails that I opened up today along the same lines, actually. One specifically was asking me my opinion on what to do when you're married to a Christian narcissist. Is my signal good? I can't tell. Is my signal good? What to do if you're coming in, would you just send me a, let me know if my signal is good. I'm outside, obviously, and I don't want to waste time. Can you all, is my signal good? Awesome. Thank you. So one was in reference to what to do if you're married to a Christian narcissist. And then not long after, I read another email where, you know, person was pretty much asking the same thing. How do you manage, you know, when you're married to a narcissist and you have children? And as I was sitting here and just pondering it, there's an Old Testament text that came to mind that I think captures captures what happens in the mind of a person that is married to or marries a Christian narcissist. And it's found in the book of Esther. I don't think I'm going to read all of these verses. It's found in the book of Esther, and it's the story between King Ahasuerus and Queen Vashti. And Queen Vashti was the queen that came before Esther. Everybody knows about Esther. But before there was Esther, I don't know why my tongue is moving so slowly. Before there was Esther, there was Vashti. And the story, I'll just tell you the story. The story behind Vashti, which made Esther possible, is that her husband, the king, this is found in Esther 1, her husband, the king, got drunk and he had a party. There was a party going on. And so the king wanted Vashti to parade herself, to show her beauty to all of the other princes and kings or whoever, you know, the dignitaries were that were present. And Vashti, the queen, refused to demean herself like that. And so she said no, and she just did not show up. The king called for her. She refused to show up. So the guys that were surrounding the king, they said, you know, what's going to happen? Your wife is not doing what you tell her to do. What's going to happen with all of the wives around the kingdom and in other lands when they hear that the king's wife disobeyed him? All other women will follow suit. And so the king said, well, we're basically going to take everything from Vashti, basically banish her. And then somebody said, well, let us start looking for some beautiful young women. In fact, I think it was the king that suggested, find some beautiful young women for me. But the reason I bring this story up, and you can read the story, it's just a lot of verses, and I don't fill up to reading all of that right now, in Esther 1. The reason I bring that up is because this story kind of mirrors the psychology of a person that is marrying, especially if you're Christian and you're marrying a so-called Christian man, um, it probably felt like you were marrying your dream, you know? And like I imagine, Vashti imagined, she was marrying her dream, marrying the king, you know? What could go wrong with this? This is the king, you know, this is the royal life. And the thing that we fail to understand is that a person's title, a person's status in life or involvements in society are no real indication of that person's character. So you'll have so-called Christian men or Christian women who paint themselves as the perfect one. And you think that because they are Christian and they are supposed to be living by the biblical ethic, the Christian ethic, that I can't go wrong with this, not understanding that their Christianity is really just a cover-up for something that is either diabolical or something that is broken. You know, and that's another conversation I had today. All narcissists are not necessarily demonic or diabolical. A lot of them are just broken. They've been broken from childhood. And they bring that wreckage into whatever relationship they might try to develop. And they make very poor spouses and most of the time very poor parents. And so sometimes you're marrying, you know, what you think is the ideal, like I'm certain Vashti thought. And then you discover along the way that when you exert your individuality and you have your own mind and you do something that is not in agreement with their orders or their will, you discover another person comes out. When the king said he got drunk and his real personality came out, and he said, you know, come on out here, let the people see how beautiful you are. And she said, no. Well, that's one of the greatest tests, I believe, of that a person can utilize even in the formative stages of a relationship before you go as far as getting married to a person. If you would just tell a person no and just see how they respond, what's in them will come out. If they are well adjusted and they are a healthy person, they will be able to respect your no and move forward. But if they're broken and if there's any trace of narcissism within them, at that point when you say no and you go against their will, you're going to reveal that. But you have to be conscious enough and you have to be intentional and intelligent enough not to be caught up in your emotions and looking at, you know, the Bible and looking at the suits and looking at the church going. That means nothing. When she told that man no, something else came out of him. And so a lot of times this is what happens when people marry, when women marry men that are in a certain place or has wrapped himself, you know, with certain trappings, or could be vice versa. She's wrapped herself, you know, with certain trappings to throw you off and make you think that she's one thing when she's something else. And now let me just add this before I give you these few points I want to give you. When you start talking about any person that would present him or herself as a spiritual person, be it Christianity or whatever the so-called religion is, and you know this person is supposed to be spiritual and living according to some higher ethic, you have to be careful with that. Because, you know, most religions promote empathy. Most religions promote empathy. When you look at Christianity, it promotes empathy, it promotes sympathy, it promotes compassion, and all of these things. Now, the same Bible that teaches empathy and compassion and sympathy and all of these things also teaches discernment, also teaches to beware of wolves in sheep's clothing. But we tend not to really focus on those principles as much. So what happens is, Christianity becomes a hotbed for narcissistic activity. In other words, narcissists can thrive inside of the church. Narcissists can thrive inside of Christianity. Why? Because most of us are out of balance and we're just thinking about, you know, how to serve another or, you know, being good, being kind, loving a person through whatever they're going through and what have you. And so we go overboard with underwriting the narcissist behavior with our, you know, toxic empathy, you know, and it becomes something that becomes self-destructive. And so narcissists come many times into the church and come under the guise of Christianity to take advantage of that, the spirit of Christianity, which was never Jesus's intent. Jesus said, you know, you got to watch these people and you got to, if a person doesn't receive you, dust your feet and keep it moving, you know, but we take it to the next level and you get the point. Another thing I noticed when you read the Esther 1 account of the king and Vashti, you'll also notice these people around the king that were, you know, encouraging him to do the worst to Vashti. And there's this terminology that I recently learned about flying monkeys. I need to study it more. But these are people that, you know, come out of the relationship with the narcissist into your life to do the bidding of the narcissist to basically destroy your life. So we see even the flying monkeys there, you know, in this situation. Thank you, Teresa. And, you know, I just thought it was interesting to mention this text. When you read it, when you start thinking about this and you start reading the Bible, you see that this is addressed more than we realize, you know, not just Jezebel, but we see a narcissist here in the person of King Ahasuerus. Read Esther 1 and just kind of, you know, take your time and look at the story and how it develops and look at everything that goes on. And then he gets to the point where he says at the beginning of chapter 2, in verse 1, it says, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was pacified, he earnestly remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Then the king's servants who ministered to him said, let beautiful young virgin, so it was his servants, be sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the capital in Shushan. So we see here, this is the equivalent of a narcissist taking and utilizing. All of this was done to hurt who? Vashti. All of this was done to hurt Vashti. Now, I think in the end, I think he genuinely developed a love for Esther. But initially, this was done to send a message to Vashti to hurt her. And you see that happen quite frequently on social media or, again, the flying monkeys, these people that come into your life to bring you news that you don't need, didn't ask for, and just to hurt you and so forth and so on. But I thought it was interesting because this story represents a marriage where a person had a certain ideal expectation and it turned out to be horrific instead of what they thought. And so this is the case many times with women who marry Christian men or men who marry Christian women or people who sincerely get married at all. You're getting married to a person and you think that it's just going to be a fairy tale. This is why you spend all of that money to have all of this stuff go on, to have this celebration of y'all, of the union, because you think this is going to be just a fairy tale. And then when you get into the heat of it and you really begin to try to exert yourself as an individual, you see the other side of this person, or should I say the real side of this person. And so when one is married to a Christian narcissist, there are a few things that I jotted down that I sent to a certain person in an email this morning. Number one, when you're married to a Christian narcissist, one thing I believe that you have working for you when you're married to a Christian narcissist, one thing I believe that you have working for you is that a Christian narcissist clearly has a high need for a righteous persona in public. In other words, they're going to really be protective of how the public perceives them, how the church perceives them, how leadership in the church perceives them. So they're not like a narcissist that does not have any religious or spiritual ties, who is just free to go completely berserk with no concern for maintaining any righteous impression. When you're married to a Christian narcissist, there's a real high need for them to protect their public image of being a righteous, spiritual, godly person. And so that really can work in your favor, because it kind of restrains them to a certain extent. You know, things that they normally would do, they won't do, because they don't want the public backlash, or they don't want their persona marred by, you know, something coming out on social media, or something being in the papers, or so I would say, and these are just my thoughts, and as I always say, I'm no therapist, I'm no psychologist, no psychiatrist, none of that, no counselor, I'm just a pastor, and I'm a man, and these are my thoughts as I look at life. Number one, I would say when you're married to a Christian narcissist, it almost sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? You need to make your feelings known sooner than later. Sooner than later. You need to make your feelings known. This is where you just kind of articulate, you know, this is not what I thought we were doing. This is not what I signed up for. And of course, they're going to probably, not more than likely, definitely get a little jarred by that. But, you know, this is not what I thought I was getting into. This is what you're doing, but this is what I need. This is what I expect. And you can kind of throw it out there. Maybe we need to talk to Pastor. And when you say that, they're going to really guard themselves, because, again, they're protecting this what? False persona. Being a Christian and being viewed as a man or woman of God in the church gives them a sense of esteem. And so they don't, at that point, you're using wise passive aggression. And sometimes passive aggression is one's only means of surviving when you're dealing with a person that can be as unpredictable and as volatile as a narcissist. You're using passive aggression to deal with this situation. And so now they're gonna pause, because at this point they don't want to push you to the point that you might run off the rails. Now you've really given them some of their own medicine. And so they're going to really be careful about how they proceed from this point, because you're mentioning talking to people that they highly respect. Or at least they, you know, they act like they highly respect, but they need these people's approval to feel like they're somebody. And so then you find them calm. Oh, no, we'll work on it. We'll work on it. We'll work on it. We'll work on it. Then you find that nothing really changes. And so then you move to the point where, and of course, you choose your times. You don't instigate. You don't bring these conversations up or make these points when it's, you know, in the heat of an argument, because, you know, a person that is as toxic as this is very unpredictable and can become very violent, man. I'm telling you. Now, let me just share this with you. I never, you know, I've been living with this all of my life, but it's just been a few years ago that I started really looking at narcissism and, you know, narcissistic abuse from the Bibles, from the biblical perspective, and even in terms of the community of the church. And it's changed the way I see everything. I've been in counseling sessions where I've seen the narcissist rise up in a person, and I've seen that rage behind a person's eyes, you know, to the point that I've actually stood up to make certain that this person didn't get at the other person. And I must say, most of the time it was men, but sometimes it was women, and it was the man who was actually the victim of the narcissistic abuse. So my point is, this person is very unpredictable. You don't just take and willy-nilly throw this stuff out there because you don't know what the repercussions are going to be. So you choose your times, you choose your places to bring certain things up and to deal with certain things. So number one, make your feelings known, how you exactly feel about things. Number two, demand counseling. Nothing's going to change. So at some point you have to demand counseling. You know, I'm not happy. I don't think you're happy either. This is not working for us. And I think if we're going to move forward, we need counseling. Well, now you know then they're going to tell you, I'm not going to the church. I don't need those people at church telling me nothing. I know the Bible for myself. We can work this out together. And you demand counseling. And you say, well, no, I don't want church counseling. I want an independent individual, a professional, not necessarily a Christian counselor, a professional that can look at what we're dealing with, a professional marriage counselor, preferably a therapist or a psychologist, to look at what we're dealing with and give us their point of view. The third thing, which is probably the first thing, actually, but it's just the third thing I listed in my response, is that you have to be very prayerful, because when you're dealing with this kind of situation, you want to really engage God. You want God. You don't want to be fighting spiritual battles. Somebody said, just plan a way to escape. Yeah. Well, all of this is actually, you know, when you are in the process, when you know what you're dealing with, and that you're really getting ahead of my lesson, actually, when you know what you're dealing with, all of this is the process of working your way to a certain point. I forget my thought now. I was saying, be very prayerful. You don't want to be fighting spiritual battles with carnal methods or carnal means. You want to pray, because you're going to need God to give you a sense of what? Wisdom. You're going to need God to give you a sense of peace. And you're going to need God to give you a sense of discretion, to know when and how to do what. Because if you make the wrong move at the wrong time, you can reap the whirlwind. The fourth thing I said to the person in the email was, establish your boundaries. You know, begin to establish invisible boundaries. And what do I mean by that? You know, when you're married to a person, it's kind of hard to establish physical boundaries. Of course, it's your right not to engage in sexual activity. And if a person tries to force that on you, you should use the telephone, you know, exit the premises and use the telephone. But beyond that, you have to begin to establish these emotional boundaries where you insulate your mind from this person's assault. You know, because what happens with the victims of narcissistic abuse is that you tend to internalize and personalize the problems in the relationship, and you view them as your fault. And they'll, you know, the person that you're married to, especially if they really know the Bible, they can use the Bible as a weapon to make you feel guilty about what they're doing to you. And so you have to begin to establish these boundaries in your mind where you don't let them get in your head anymore, and you begin to talk to yourself, and you begin to emotionally divorce yourself from this person to the point that they have no impact on you. What happens with a lot of people who exit these kinds of relationships is that you exit physically before you've exited emotionally. So when you get out physically, the guilt seed that has been planted in your mind comes back to torment you. Whereas if you begin to really look at this person for who they are and what they are, and you divorce yourself, you divorce your soul from them, you break the soul tie with this person, you begin to establish these emotional boundaries with this person. When you make the physical shift, you have the internal infrastructure to maintain it. Right? And then what is that? 1, 2, 3, 4. Then here's number 5. Recognize when this thing is breaking your soul and take charge. Now, one of the things I rarely, if ever, do is tell somebody to leave your spouse. Rarely, if ever, will I tell somebody to leave your spouse. But what I will say is save yourself. And a lot of times, people in the church who are very legalistic and overly religious will tell you to hang in there. And when that person, if that person kills you in a fit of rage, those same people that told you to hang in there won't even show up at your funeral. At some point, you have to be able to look at a situation personally and say, this is not what God intended for me. Now, I may have created something, but this is not what God created or intended for me. And this is destroying me. And then you have to make a personal decision. You don't need anybody's approval to save you. Now, that's, you know, there are a lot of religious folk who are probably going to give me a thumbs down on this one, but you don't need anybody's approval to save you. If you're up in a house and a person is threatening your life or you're about to lose your mind, your children are being, something is biting me. I think we thought it was too cool for mosquitoes. Your children are being assaulted emotionally and all of this kind of thing. I'm sorry. You don't need anybody's approval to save you. You don't need anybody's approval to save you. When you realize that this thing is breaking your soul, take charge. Take charge. And then what you do is you begin to gather your true circle, people that are going to support you. This is why in the process of this kind of marriage, you don't allow this person to isolate you from everybody that loves you. Don't let that happen. Let this person isolate you from everybody that loves you. Because when the time comes that you have to make power moves, you're going to need your circle. You know what I mean? You're going to need your circle. Thank you, Tanga. And when that time comes, you just got to do it. You got to be bold enough to do it. You know, it is a frightening thing, but fear will cost you your life. It really will. You will lose your whole life operating in fear. At some point you have to just simply be bold enough to take charge and do what you have to do without any consideration for what their response might be. At some point, the courage in you has to just simply take over. At some point, the courage in you has to just simply take over. So that's just, you know, a conversation I wanted to have with you all as I was sitting and responding to emails. And move forward with your life. no concern, no consideration at all for what people think or what people say. This is your life. And ultimately, you have to live it. And as you begin to make these moves, seek the Spirit of God. You will find a peace and a rest about the decisions that you're making. Anything that is not in sync with God and His will for you, you will not find peace. When you find peace, sometimes you're so busy focusing on what they think, what people think, that you're not really locked in on what God is saying. And sometimes God is telling you, run, Forrest, run. Run, Forrest, run. And you're worrying about what the deacon board's going to say. I could care less what the deacon board is going to say. They do not live in this hell with me. And those are my thoughts relative to this. All right. Thank you all for giving me some of your time this afternoon. I know this is at an awkward time, but I just wanted to do it while I felt it. Somebody got hallelujah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Leslie Lester, God bless you. Have a great one. Have a great one. Know that Lisa and I love you, and enjoy the rest of your day. And maybe there's some things that you can add to this conversation. Why don't you put it in the chat there? Just, you know, even after this goes off, just add it, because people read all of that. And there are things that some of you could probably add that might be helpful. Those were just some thoughts that were on the top of my head. All right. Father, I thank you for every person today as they go forth. I thank you for giving them a sense of peace and confidence and rest. And God, I thank you for making their ways plain. Thank you for giving them a sense of courage and confidence that they are covered and protected by you. And God, I thank you that no weapon formed against them will prosper. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, God bless you. Love you. Have a great one.
Thank you for listening today. If you would like more information or for other resources, please visit us on the web at rcblakes.com.